This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Network. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Network does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Advancing the Science of Addiction, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander, and today's episode, we have the privilege of speaking to two great scholars, Dr. Lisa Farinelli, PhD, MBA, RN, who serves as the Deputy Clinical Director, and the NIDA IRP and Dr. Stephen B. Thomas, PhD, who serves as Professor, Health Policy and Management Director for Center for Health Equity at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Dr. Farinelli and Dr. Thomas, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Now, I would start off, Dr. Farinelli, could you please tell our listeners what the NIDA IRP and what it is and what you guys really do there?
Sure. Happy to. So the National Institute on Drug Abuse, that's the NIDA that you'll hear us referred to as, the NIDA, is one of the 27 institutes and centers of the National Institutes of Health. The NIDA is dedicated to understanding the causes and the consequences and the treatments of substance use disorder. To meet this enormous responsibility, NIDA operates a research facility, and that's what we refer to as the IRP, or the Intramural Research Program. We're located on the Johns Hopkins Bayview campus in East Baltimore. Our mission there, again, is to better understand substance use disorders and the many variables and factors that may contribute to this enormous medical, public health, and societal problem, while working to translate these efforts into new methods for the prevention and treatment of substance use disorder.
Dr. Farinelli, if you met somebody at a restaurant and they said, what do you do for a living? And they go, I'm a lawyer. And they say, what do you do for a living? You would say, What about your job?
Great question. It comes up quite often when you say deputy clinical director. Of course, people understand the deputy by definition means that you're serving at the pleasure of, and that is true for me as well. I serve at the pleasure of the clinical director, Dr. Lorenzo Leggio, who I believe you've met previously, as well as our scientific director, Dr. Amy Newman. But the truth is, my position was created to ensure that we have the proper resources and infrastructure in place so that all of our clinical investigators and their respective teams can conduct and maintain the safest and most ethical human subjects research at the IRP, at the Intramural Research Program. We also have a responsibility to make sure we do it in a fiscally responsible manner. Therefore, my job actually encompasses regulatory, clinical, scientific, management, administrative. So you can imagine with that many challenges and what I would say on the opposite side of the coin, opportunities, come into my day-to-day. There's also many opportunities for inspiration and fulfillment. So it is a very dynamic position and one of great responsibility, but certainly a blessing.
It definitely sounds like you are a very busy person. That is a the one-arm paper hanger. I mean, that is a lot of work that you're doing. But I'm glad you mentioned about how rewarding it must be for you.
Yes.
As somebody, my brother sadly passed away with a drug overdose right after the pandemic. And he dealt with mental health issues his whole life, schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. And it's something that unless you have somebody close in your life that you love with all your heart, you don't realize what mental illness, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And for him, he was on heavy duty medication to regulate his issues. Mm-hmm. But for him, he said that there were no highs, there were no lows, mm-hmm. that it was just like a dullness. Mm. And that's what led him to drug abuse. And what you guys are doing there is really God's work. And pardon me for bringing the Lord into this, but I truly mean it. I mean, if people who are suffering, It's just horrible. And the fact that you guys are doing what you can to make these people's lives better and more healthy is commendable. I'm sure it does. You know, you can look in the mirror in the morning when you know what you do for a living.
Thank you, Jimmy. And I couldn't agree more. To have an opportunity to support world-renowned scientists and the most dedicated colleagues you can imagine in the federal government at NIDA working along with trainees, literally who show up day to day to literally improve the lives of so many others, I'm given that opportunity to support them. So you're correct. It is a very fulfilling opportunity.
And do you remember, when did you start there? I apologize if I...
I've been in the government over a decade now, so yeah. I'm serving. Yeah.
Did you know that when you walked in the door for the first time that the next decade of your life would be dedicated to this?
That's a great question. Yeah. That's a great question. But the truth is, you do know it's special from the day you arrive, but the discovery continues to happen on a daily basis. And that's what I speak to new employees as well as veterans, that's the remarkable public service. That's the remarkable characteristic of being a public service. But in being in healthcare, it's just remarkable.
Well, I forgive me because most people don't like compliments, but thank you for all your work. And sure. Speaking of thanks, there's another person here who I need to thank.
Yes.
Dr. Thomas, I would love for you to find out what your role as professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Health and your role as the director for the Center for Health Equity. Tell us what. That's a lot of words. It sounds important. You would need 3 business cards to really fit that all in. But kind of share what your day-to-day responsibilities and tasks are.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to your audience, and most importantly, to be here with my dear friend, Dr. Lisa Farinelli. You know, at the University of Maryland School of Public Health, I'm a troublemaker. I'm a disruptor. In the communities that I work in and that Dr. Farinelli is interested in trying to help solve their human suffering, those communities sometimes live in the shadow of all of our wonderful science, and yet they're suffering from all the things we say we're expert in. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is my best to translate the science of medicine and public health into culturally tailored community-based interventions, and to do that at the hyper-local level. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic really was a stress test for us in public health. I think many of your listeners probably heard public health for the first time and knew how it was different from medicine for the first time. Yes, we were the ones calling for you to put on a mask. Yes, we were the ones calling for you to stay home from school and work, unless you were an essential worker. And a lot of those essential workers, the guy who picks up the garbage, the folks who had to come to work in order to feed their families, they had to expose themselves to the virus. Mm-hmm. And that's why we had a disproportionate impact of COVID in the Black community. But there were lessons that we learned, and Dr. Farinelli and her team observed those lessons, which is you must first build trust. You must be trustworthy. And in the title of my center, the Maryland Center for Health Equity, it's all about fairness. So in order to be fair, we may have to do something extra, something different. And so what's amazing, we said, why don't we go where people already have trust? And you know what's interesting? That was the Black barbershops and beauty salons. Mm. I told Dr. Farinelli, nobody's late for their appointment for their hair.
No, you better not be.
I told her that in the Black community, you know, no self-respecting Black barber would ever say, I'll get you in and out in 10 minutes. And it doesn't matter how much hair you have, you got to tell your listening audience, I got a close-cut shave on the top. I still may be there half a day, catching up on the news, learning things. Whole families are there. And for many of my white friends, they've never experienced that at their shops.
Mm-hmm.
They would never think of asking a health-related question where they get their hair done. But in the Black community, we have found that to be an opportunity for a new relationship. And so in many ways, in terms of interacting with the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, I came through the back door because the intramural research activities that Dr. Farinelli is involved in are the NIDA researchers inside their own research operation. and they don't award grants. They do their own thing inside their operation. And she reached out and recognized, she's a troublemaker. I'm going to tell you, she's a troublemaker, but she also knows how to keep us out of trouble.
Thank you.
And so with her regulatory oversight and her insight about how the rules work and her willingness to do waivers if necessary, we launched a campaign to actually engage barbers and stylists and their clients in a little mini research project. We call it a feasibility. Is it feasible and is it acceptable to collect hair samples in a barbershop? When I first talked to her, I said, I'm seeing all this being swept up and thrown in the trash. I'll just collect the trash. She said, no, Dr. Thomas, it has to be done properly.
she took the fun out of everything.
And so we had to, we literally put together a IRB. IRB stands for Institution Review Board. That's the ethical obligation to do no harm, the ethical obligation to get informed consent. And believe it or not, there's an ethical obligation of justice. Those are the three bioethical principles that we operate in today. And that principle of justice says that those who bear the burden of research should not be denied the benefit. You can't go down to some foreign country where people are poor and suffering and come up with your new blockbuster drug, and yet those people can't afford it. When we apply that here in the United States, those who suffer the burden of disease should not be denied the benefit of our solutions.
Well, thank you, Dr. Thomas. We're going to talk more about that and what happened in the barbershop coming up here on Advancing the Science.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Thanks for hanging out with us. I'm Jimmy Alexander on Advancing the Science of Addiction, and we have Dr. Farinelli and Dr. Thomas with us, and we were just talking about the culture in the black barbershops. And I want to tell you a funny story, and you'll both will be the barbershop. And they were all looking at me like they realized, oh, the white guy just showed up. And it was so much fun because the look on everybody's face when they came in and they saw the white guy sitting in the chair. And I had one of the best haircuts, and I went back there 3 or 4 times. It was wonderful. So I have a very near and dear love for barbershops. But ironically, Dr. Thomas, when we think about old school medicine, weren't barbers involved in a lot of times? Like they were dentists and barbers and doctors, right?
You know, we can go back to the roots of the profession that goes all the way back to early times, even when de Tocqueville came to America. You know, you're surprised at the relationship between whites and blacks and the whole history of slavery. Black barbershops existed back then, too.
Mm.
But you know what's interesting back then? I'm going to cut your hair on the back porch. I'm going to cut your hair out in the yard or in the basement. Or when did it become a business? And that's what's so interesting about that history, that there was a period of time where black barbers really only served wealthy white men.
Mm.
That's when it became a business, all right? But a segregated business. So white men, businessmen, would come into the shop, and black barbers would have shops for them. And you should see the photos back in that time period. And it was interesting. They would come in and do what they do, what businessmen do, smoke cigars, talk about business. But they formed a relationship with their barber. Hey, Joe, why don't you own this building?
Mm-hmm.
Little comments like that over time. And over time, Maryland was a ground zero for some of them, where black barbers actually owned their buildings. Mm-hmm. Here in Baltimore, in Maryland, Baltimore City was one of the cities where they were more likely to actually own their buildings. Baltimore was a part of that great migration coming out of the South. You may have heard of the book, The Warmth of Other Suns. And in that story, as they dropped out into Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Baltimore, the freedom they thought they were coming to wasn't always there. Mm. So they had to start their own businesses. And barbershops and salons were one of them. But across the board, Yes. You'd get your we actually had people who have sat in the chair this year reflecting back on their grandfather's time and would say, my granddad used to get his teeth fixed in the barbershop. My granddad used to get, and today they're getting their blood pressures done in the barbershop.
That barbersaw will clean anything, right? So you can put the scissors or pliers or whatever.
The blue
barbersaw is right.
Now, can I ask you this question, Dr. Thomas? When you ask the barbers if you could do this and explain to them what you were doing, that it was for the greater good, what were the reaction of the barbers?
Well, you know, it's interesting because of the history of research abuse in the black community. I spent a whole year not asking anything, just sitting there and being a customer. You know, you go in, you don't take off all your degrees and everything. You're just, you know, brother in the hood and need a haircut. But one day I saw the power of that place where someone came in, we'll call him Joe. People hadn't seen him for a while. Hey, Joe, where you been? You know? Now, when Joe comes in, the music's on, all right? The TV's on, more than one TV. And all this noise and everybody's talking at the same time, but everyone's also listening. And so Joe says, they said I had a heart attack. I've been in the hospital for 3 days. He makes his way to the chair. I see him sitting there. And now at that time, with all this noise, and the barber's right in your ear. And I saw Joe pull out a bottle. And I knew it was a prescription bottle. And he says, the doctor says I have to take these pills the rest of my life. And that's when everybody started listening. And the barber said, Joe, if you take those pills, you won't be able to keep up your obligations. Now, do I need to tell your white audience what obligations are? I said to myself,
Yeah.
Everybody's listening. I said, what if the barber would have said, hey, Joe, if you're experiencing side effects, erectile dysfunction, let your doctor know. Don't be ashamed. And
how old do you think Joe was, would you say?
Joe was in his 30s.
Oh, my God. So he is on heart medication. Oh,
yes,
my
it happens
Lord.
Early. And nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. And so I knew then that Joe was not going to take those pills. Hypertension is a silent disease. Joe is not going to maybe even go back to the doctor because he's not taking the pills. But his cardiologist has no idea. There's somebody in the community with that level of influence. Mm-hmm. And I said, what if they were our partners? And that's how HAIR, Health Advocates in Reach and Research, began.
Well, first of all, I mean, you must be so proud, I mean, of what you were able to achieve with that. And then that, you know, what you're doing is saving lives. You know, I would hear this from my mom. My mom was born in 38, and she would say, she had her mom died of a stroke from not taking her blood pressure medication. And guess what my mother did or didn't do? She didn't take hers because she would say, well, the pharmaceutical companies are pushing pills on you. Mm. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Mom! I mean, and sadly, the same thing happened to her that happened to her mom. And it was, they were from that generation.
Yeah.
But hearing somebody in their 30s, it's like, hey, no, please take the pills.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why people are wary or hesitant. Again, the pandemic was a stress test. Now, let's fast forward to the pandemic. So we've been in the shops for years with blood pressure, hypertension, and then the pandemic hits. And we found that our shops were places where the misinformation was being circulated. And so that was a real campaign of turning that around to turn those shops in the places where you could actually be vaccinated, needles in arms. And that's when it really came out. You know what they said? They said, Dr. T, that's the nickname they gave me, are they going to give us the jab and leave us with the cancer? Are they going to give us the vaccine for COVID and leave us with the diabetes? And I said no to them. And I told Dr. Farinelli I said no to them. And I reached out to her for help. And she listened to me. And we did our first pilot, hugely successful. And as a result, now we have momentum where the barbers and stylists are asking for more services. How can we be part of research? Gosh. How can our community benefit from the actual science that's happening in that building over there.
Let me ask you, for those who may hear you say that that there was mistrust in research among the African-American community, some people may not know why. Do you mind explaining why?
Well, if you look back at some of the news coverage during the pandemic, particularly here in Maryland, what were the news people describing as the reason? And the most common reason that came up was the legacy, the history of the U.S. Public Health Service syphilis study done at Tuskegee from 1932 to 1972. That's 40 years. It's the longest non-therapeutic experiment on humans in the history of medicine and public health. It was successful. They kept them in there for 40 years. When the story broke in 1972, it was front page news. The study was still going on. Fast forward to 1997, President Bill Clinton formally apologized to the man. How many years is that?
Yeah.
So here's a president, 1997, apologizing. He wasn't even alive in 1932. An apology means I'm sorry. What we need to do is move towards atonement, which means making things better. And I think that's what we're doing here with Dr. Farinelli and her team at NIDA. How do we make things better? And to do it in a way that goes the extra mile if that's necessary. So that's the history. But here's another piece, that during the pandemic, the children and the grandchildren of those men who were in that study, they did a ad council PSA. And they said, do not use the suffering of our ancestors as your excuse for not being vaccinated. So what a nice full circle. Don't use the suffering of the past to deny our community opportunity for this life-saving vaccine. So that's that history. We need to let your audience know that that legacy is now being addressed by the survivors, the family members. Don't use that as your excuse for not going to the doctor, for not taking your medicine. But some of what we have to deal with is what happens every day. Like last month when Aunt Mabel went to the doctor and was mistreated. What happened a year ago when my dad went and he was disrespected. That's even more evident. So Dr. Farinelli and her team recognize that they need to be present. They didn't just tell us to go into the shops. They came into the shops with us, and then they invited the barbers and the stylists. Are you ready for this? To the NIDA laboratories, where they actually met the scientist that analyzed the hair samples. They saw all the equipment. They saw all the bells and whistles and was completely demystified. And then they said, how can we get more of this?
Well, Dr. Thomas, this is so compelling. You'll find out more coming up on Advancing the Science.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Thanks for sticking around with us here on Advancing the Science of Addiction. I'm Jimmy Alexander here with Dr. Farinelli and Dr. Thomas. Now, Dr. Thomas, you just mentioned when you brought in the stylist and the barbers and you had them introduce them to the scientists, and really one needed the other to make this successful. I mean, really working hand in hand in one of the worst pandemics we've had in 100 years, saving lives, the barbers, the stylists, and the scientists.
Can you imagine? They walk into the room and what happens? Magic.
They're all wearing white coats, which I like already.
Well, you know, we were in the lobby of the Bayview Labs in Baltimore and waiting for our host to come down to take us through security. And one of the barbers looks around and he says, I built this building. I built this, and he literally built this building. He was one of the construction supervisor when that building went up. And that's when I realized that here they are living in the shadow of all of this science. Here's a man who's literally helped build this building.
With his own two
hands. And his community is suffering all that we say we're expert in. So that was his eye opener. He belonged there. You see what I'm saying? He
Absolutely.
Belonged there in that space. And I think that's what prevailed as we then met the scientists. And I'll let Dr. Farinelli share with you their thoughts, because up to that point, for many of them, we'd only met in Zoom, another aspect of the pandemic. I'll call it a silver lining, because for many of the barbers and stylists and their family members and others, this technology's been a real hurdle. We were all thrown into the deep end of the pool, so to speak, but they're now a little more comfortable in this Zoom space, and as a result, they've met Dr. Farinelli, they've met the whole science team there at NIDA, and we would have regular Monday meetings, and then the visit on-site. Amazing.
And Dr. Farinelli, from being a part of this, from the first Zoom to seeing them in person and kind of witnessing really the first line of defense with that community about making sure that they're getting vaccinated, learning the truth about what's really going on with the pandemic. What was that like for you and your staff?
Yeah. So Dr. Thomas did a beautiful job narrating our experience from beginning to current date. But to be honest with you, it really did start with his fundamental foundational work in the community that I read about a newspaper clipping going back 5 years ago. That literally his passion was just popping off the text. It was palpable. And I didn't know Dr. Thomas. No one at the IRP was
so the
working
first
with
time,
Dr. Thomas.
Pardon me to interrupt you. The first time
okay.
you saw, I'm good at it, I apologize.
It's okay.
But the first time you even knew of him
right.
is reading that article.
That's what I'm trying to explain to you, is that the passion you're hearing in his voice, and that extends now to his team, I was feeling in the text, in an article in a newspaper. And that it motivated me and inspired me. I was so intrigued that regardless of where this is going to take me, I knew I had to meet this man. Because first of all, he was successful in establishing a trusted space. You heard Dr. Thomas just now talk about how important it is to develop a respected, trusted space with any individual that you hope to care for and improve their lives. And that, in a very humble way, I must confess, our scientific team needed to learn how to do a better job. And that's what you hear Dr. Thomas describing right now, is it's not just physical barriers. There's other perceived and real barriers that our scientific community, based on the history that you described, as well as to date, can always improve and learn from. And that's when I reached out to Dr. Thomas and asked him to help us cross that threshold in that trusted space. And that's exactly what Dr. Thomas did, and we're forever grateful. So it really has been an ongoing, and also I must impress upon you, the Monday meetings Dr. Thomas is talking about, this isn't a few weeks. This isn't a few months. This is a four-year dedicated every week, bringing scholars, trainees, administrators, scientists, investigators together to talk about how we can better serve, how can we be better listeners, how can we learn from the very people that we show up every day to better serve?
Doctor, I hate to interrupt you because it's just so moving to me
yeah.
that you have these folks in the community who have full-time jobs, standing on their feet 8, 9, 10 hours a day. I can't imagine how their hands hurt. There's probably
carpal tunnel
syndrome, arthritis. And I mean, they're really working. And the fact that they would be able, that they would volunteer their time to have these meetings with you guys to really help save the lives of people in their community says a lot about them as human beings.
It does, but remember, it's a bidirectional exchange of knowledge and information. So we weren't taking, we weren't asking. There was a bidirectional, they're giving, they're teaching the scientists, and the scientists in return are sharing the knowledge and information. And the barbers and hair salonists are then turning that back to the people in their chair. That's literally the foundation of what Dr. Thomas and I and our entire team at NIDA have been trying to do. So it really is a beautiful collaboration.
Dr. Thomas, were you surprised that it worked? that it worked as well as it did?
You know, I was surprised that we're finally aligned. Mm. We've been talking in the literature, scientific literature, about diversity in the clinical research enterprise. You have to understand that a lot of the research that we now rely on comes from a limited pool of people who agree to sign up for clinical trials. Mm. And unfortunately, historically, women and minorities have been left out. There may be a whole lot of reasons of why. I gave you one example, but there are many other reasons. Even your story about your grandmother or your mom and, you know, pharmaceutical companies. We have all those things happening. So it really does take trusted messenger. So it's not just the message, it's also the messenger. Mm. Another example of recognizing that the barbers and stylists are business people standing on their feet, mm-hmm. okay, doing hair care in the stylist world that might include chemicals that come into the air that they breathe. Okay, now for the person in the, sitting in the chair, you may come in every 3 months to get your hair colored or whatever it might be, but that stylist might be there for five people. We wanted to know to what extent are they inhaling chemicals that might be related to diseases such as cancer, et cetera. And so little project, we put in air monitors in a salon that literally captured the ambient air, and we collected samples from the stylists to measure exposure to chemicals. And we published this in one of the big journals and recognize that stylists who work in black hair care, you know, all the different chemicals, are actually exposed to levels of cancer-causing chemicals. Mm. And therefore, we should not just point out the problem. Here's the past. We point out the problem, then we leave them with the problem. Mm. Our point, we point out that problem, and now we mitigate. How do we mitigate? Who would have known that the pandemic gave us a mitigation strategy? The air filters. We built Corsi Rosenthal boxes. I don't know if your audience knows about that. These are these HEPA filters using a box fan that literally would take COVID out of the air. And if it took COVID, a virus, out of the air, it could take some of those chemicals that they're breathing in the barbershop and the salon out of the air. So when we did that, the stylist said, it's a conversation piece now. People say, well, what is that? Oh, that's the Corsi Rosenthal box. Well, what's that do? Well, that cleans the air. And now we have a conversation about how viruses spread. This is why you need the mask. We have to reach people where they are with a level of understanding and examples and metaphors that they understand, because they were being overwhelmed with all that information about mRNA vaccines. And it was just overwhelming. And so I think that our willingness to bring the experts before them and the willingness of the experts to listen and not shame or blame and bring their language down to a level that the community could understand really made a difference. And then when they literally saw that translated into, hey, they're inviting us into their house at the scientists. And there's one thing that Dr. Farinelli hasn't told you yet, that after that visit, the NIDA team came back to the barbershop where those hair samples were collected, and we did a health clinic. We literally taught people. We taught them how to save lives with Narcan. Mm. With Narcan. Because our barbers and stylists are literally seeing, and they're in the neighborhoods, where they're seeing people who are suffering from substance use disorders. And that Narcan can save lives. They've been trained and given Narcan. And when you see on their face, because they were in the business of helping their communities before we showed up, when you see on their face the gratitude and their thankfulness for having that, and then we come back and hear they actually used it, you know that they're not trying to be second-class health professionals. This is an extension of our health network to what I call the last-mile communities. Sometimes we just can't get it the last mile. Our barbers and stylists are part of that last-mile community. They need to be sustained. You can't just abandon them or just go to them in the middle of a crisis.
It's amazing to hear this. I mean, really, you're everybody working together to save lives. And boy, is that what more can you say about a community helping each other? More with Advancing the Science of Addiction next.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Advancing the Science of Addiction is back. My name is Jimmy Alexander, and we really appreciate you spending some time with us today. I'm here with Dr. Farinelli and Dr. Thomas. Now, Dr. Farinelli, just the work that you guys have done and are doing, it really makes you feel good to be a member of the community. I mean, you brought in the scientists, and you had them meet with stylists and barbers to really not only about the pandemic and about COVID and getting vaccinations, but also teaching people to really save lives with Narcan. It really is just wonderful what you guys are doing.
Thank you, Jimmy. And I would just compliment and add on to what Dr. Thomas said earlier that is true. We did go back out into the community, and we continue to work on having a presence in the community because that's what Dr. Thomas and his team taught us.
Dr. Farinelli, yes. I have to I feel like I want to thank you both over and over again because the fact that what you guys are doing are saving lives. And as I told you, somebody who's lost a family member because of drug addiction, I would do, if you told me that you needed somebody to wash cars for charity, I would come there and do it to help you guys.
But sign him up. Sign him up.
Well, I got a bad shoulder. Hold on, let me think about it. But I know that you all thank these professionals.
That's correct.
You went back to the community and thanked them for all their work, the barbers, the stylists.
That's correct. Thank you for bringing that up, Jimmy, because in addition to thanking Dr. Thomas and his team for teaching the scientific community lessons that we continue to implement to this day, being present with and for the very people that we come to work to serve, we also went back out and continue to thank the people who participated in our research that Dr. Thomas was speaking about earlier. We did that physically in person, not only with health and wellness visits, educational opportunities, naloxone that Dr. Thomas mentioned, but also an actual physical thank you note, an old-fashioned physical thank you note.
You feel
and
we good.
Hand it out.
You
it was
feel good
amazing.
When you open a card, right? And it's handwritten.
And
I feel
you
good.
Just cannot believe how well-received that has been, and it was really remarkable. And that suggestion, by the way, came from a member of Dr. Thomas's team. Again, keeping us humble and keeping us grateful and focused on the needs of the community.
And, you know, going into the shops and then seeing, oh, there's that thank you card on the barber's mirror.
Yeah.
Their mirrors are everything. What they put on those mirrors is how they kind of frame who they are. Yeah. As one of the lead barbers says, you know, I don't point fingers and nag people. I just turn them to the mirror and say, did I get that straight? But they can't help but see my mirror. they can't help but see the card. And it gets them thinking. So that was the other lesson. Sometimes as health professionals, we come in telling people what they need. We don't ask them what they want today. Mm. What do you need right now? Mm. And I think that is what they're asking us to be sensitive to now. They have had the engagement. Now they want commitment. They want commitment. And They try to tell me this in different ways so that I understand. They say, hey, Dr. T, would Beyonce say, if you like what you see, put a ring on it. if Nida really likes this, tell him to put a ring on it.
Well, when you asked the first barber, were you nervous when you went in and tried to explain to him what you were wanting?
Well, you know, I actually have him on tape describing that first meeting. His name is Mike Brown. His nickname is Dynamike Brown.
Yeah.
And he says, when Dr. Thomas first came to me, he let me know that we were more than just barbers cutting hair, that we were influencers. And he says, I know I'm an influencer. People like my shoes. They try to get my shoes. They like my style. They try to get my style. And I helped them get their style. So they were already involved in helping the community with back-to-school haircuts and other activities. But they were episodic and not sustained. In some ways, they were experiencing that kind of flyby. And we're saying we need to do a better job in the health arena. Because right now, we had people saying, I'd rather come here for my vaccine than to a clinic. Mm-hmm. Well, then why don't we bring those vaccines to the barbershops mm-hmm. and salons and churches where people are? Wherever we have what we call non-invasive procedures that you don't need to be tethered to a hospital or a laboratory, we can be in the neighborhood. And that's what the model that we're trying to demonstrate looks like. And not lose any quality. In fact, get better quality mm-hmm. by being in the community where people are. We're convinced of the following. If you give people the information they need and the skills to take action, they will naturally gravitate towards saving their own lives. So we don't have to go in and nag and point fingers and shame and blame. That was our lesson from the barbers. That's how they keep their customers coming back. they have to be supporters of every yes. team. Not just one team.
The Eagles, I love them.
There you go.
if somebody is listening and they want to learn more about hair, where could they go and do that, Dr. Thomas?
Well, you know, we try our best to have our social media working. And so if they just go to Google and just type in UMD for University of Maryland, UMD Hair, H-A-I-R, it will take them to our site. And they'll have links that will take them to other places as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, this is just one of those stories that makes you feel good and to know that you guys are still doing that. And just, you know, it's what community should be all about.
But let me just say about language and Dr. Farinelli's and her team's willingness to listen to the barbers and stylists when they talk about language. When we first went into the shops, we were talking about herd immunity. I don't think we've talked about that here. Remember in the early days of the pandemic, mm-hmm. we said we need as many people to get vaccinated as possible for herd immunity. So this is February during bits of the pandemic. What's February? Black History Month. What's on TV? Back to slavery, time to freedom, civil rights movement. You know what the barber said to me? He said, Dr. T, herd immunity? We're not cattle.
Oh, no.
So I tried to explain what it meant in a public health way and from the epidemiology way. And he said, well, that sounds like community immunity.
Mm.
And that became the T-shirt. That became what Dr. Farinelli and her team were willing. Okay, we're going to talk about community immunity. So I thought that was interesting. So now they're coming back at me. Now I got to listen. And they say, Dr. T, are you taking this stuff upstream? Artificial intelligence, because we're doing a project now. We're working on addressing type 2 diabetes using artificial intelligence. You know what they said to me? They said, Dr. T, you told us to read labels, stay away from artificial sweeteners, processed foods, and now you want to bring artificial intelligence in here? So I try to explain what that is. And they said, that sounds like authentic intelligence.
Mm.
Isn't that what you want from us, Dr. T? Authentic intelligence? I said, yeah, and it's the same acronym, AI. Let me get to Dr. Farinelli and tell her. We're going to say authentic intelligence. And the last thing was, they came back to give back, and they had their banner that said, National Institutes on Drug Abuse. And I had a man standing over in the corner. He wouldn't go to Dr. Farinelli's table. And I'm sitting there talking to him at a distance. And he says, I don't have anything to do with drugs. I don't hang out with people who do drugs. I said, that's the National Institute on Drugs. The word itself.
Yeah.
Kept him at a distance, even though I explained they're here to help us. They're here to prevent substance use disorders, cancer centers, diabetes. For people of color, some of those, they don't want to walk through that door. We got to put prevention in there. We got to put wellness. We have to reframe so that people don't feel that by saying a thing or a word, somehow they're bringing that to them.
Oh, I totally understand that. There are things, side note, I went to the cardiologist, wanted to make sure, I had a big birthday, wanted to make sure everything was okay. I get there and they said, well, your heart seems wrong, but you have these, they were kind of drop-offs. I'm trying to think what some things. And it was like, there was strange. We just want to look at it. And I'm like, I was coming here to cross it off my list. I didn't know I was going to have to wear a monitor for a week. Like, well, if you feel anything weird, just push a button. And I'm like, I feel weird. five times. Now, luckily, everything was fine. They went away when my heart was elevated, so they're benign. But it was like one of those things.
Yes.
I didn't even want to tell people, because if I say it out loud.
Yeah.
And in the black community and in other cultures, I'm not just saying it's black people, but there's a sense that I don't want to own that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to own that.
Once you say it out loud, it's real.
And if you know any folks from the South.
Yeah, I grew up there.
But it's a recognition that we need to be culturally sensitive and align our message and our language to the cultural context of the community we're trying to reach without distorting or, you know, being deceptive. And I think we can do a better job. And they're giving us the language to do that.
Words matter. And that is exactly what NIDA is trying to help all of the scientific community, as well as the layperson, understand in destigmatizing, right? Destigmatizing addiction care. So you are 100% correct, Jimmy. It is, words matter for sure.
Well, you know, it's funny, Dr. Farinelli, I'm coming to you when we come back, because I want to talk about the ongoing clinical studies that you guys are doing. That's coming up next on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Advancing the Science of Addiction is back. My name is Jimmy Alexander, and again, we appreciate you spending part of your day with us. I'm here with Dr. Farinelli and Dr. Thomas. Now, at NIDA, you guys are doing a lot of great work, and one of the things that I'm just so interested in, because as anybody, and I'm sure that you, like me, have either had a family member or somebody who's close, near and dear into your heart, deal with addiction, whether it's alcoholism or whether it's with drugs. And I know that the work you guys are doing with your clinical studies is really trying to help folks.
That is true, Jimmy, and thanks for bringing that up. And destigmatizing addiction care is a major focus right now at the NIDA IRP, where we do conduct inpatient and outpatient human clinical research, behavioral drug intervention, based on those that are living at all stages of their disease process that could be alcohol-related. It could be drug-related. It could be perhaps even nicotine, tobacco, cocaine, et cetera. And we do know based on recent research that we're not always focused on abstinence per se. So as Dr. Thomas mentioned earlier, we meet people where they are. And that is a very actionable way of showing respect and care in a destigmatizing and non-judgmental way.
You remember when we brought those barbers and stylists in and they walked around the different stations?
Yes.
What was that first station we went to? We took them to the lab that was a bar. That was amazing. They have simulators.
Sure.
So in their facility, there's an actual bar.
Sure. What Dr. Thomas is referring to is, of course, innovation and discovery is what we're based on, right, at the IRP. We're always looking for discovering new care and treatment for people that are living with alcohol and or drug substance use disorders. So what Dr. Thomas is referring to is we have different mechanisms and different interventions to help learn more about one's experience wherever they are with their disease process. So we have simulation labs. Where we do look at where that craving starts, what initiates that desire to drink or to use those drugs.
Our barbers and stylists come from the very communities we're trying to help. They've had the same struggles. So they're sitting there watching this saying, wow, this could help me or this could help a family member. So you're sitting in this bar, feels like a bar. You're trying to deal with your cravings. And so there's prompts that come, and they're able to monitor you so that you can help monitor yourself, self-regulation of your cravings. In that one simulation room, I saw such power.
And you probably, as anybody who is triggered by whatever addiction they have, whether it's smoking, that they know that when they go out that they're going to smoke at a bar. Or they know after every meal they're going to go, okay, it's time to push the... the chair away from the table, and they're, you know, grabbing the smokes. If somebody would want to get involved with one of the clinical studies, how would they do that?
Sure. Anyone interested in learning more about our studies at NIDA can call us at 1-800-535-8254, or they can go to our website at Research Studies. That's one word. There's no space in between. ResearchStudies.NIDA. That's NIDA. NIH.gov.
Now, you are a fascinating person to meet, Dr. Farinelli, because I'm married to a nurse, and you are a nurse, but you have a doctorate, and you have a doctorate, and you're a nurse, and you went to business school also. So you are right, didn't you? So how did you go from being a nurse to doctor?
Literally, what being a federal civilian at the NIH offers. Not only to our colleagues, but to our patients. And that is, it's all about growth. It's all about learning. And my colleagues lift up patients every day to learn more about their disease process and where they are, to improve their lives with their families and their communities. But so do we to each other as colleagues. We lift one another up. So I am here today because of my colleagues' support. And you are correct. It has been an academic journey. I do advocate for continuing learning, which also happens in the community, thanks to Dr. Thomas, every day with NIDA in collaboration with the University of Maryland.
Well, Dr. Thomas, you, sir, with the University of Maryland, what led you to the career that you have now? How did your path start?
Well, my mother was a nurse. And, you know, it's only after your parents have transitioned that you really appreciate the fact that that voice in your head, your mom talking to you.
I understand that.
And so one of the things my sister told me, she said, you know, start reminiscing on anniversaries and things. She says, I remember when mom would be in the kitchen crying. I said, Mother, why are you crying? She says, Miss McGillicuddy died.
Oh.
Well, who's Miss McGillicuddy? My patient. She felt that way towards all her patients. They would wait for her to come on duty to get their injections. So that influenced me. That was old school, you know, when the nurses put the white hats on, mm-hmm. white shoes and everything. And so as an undergraduate working my way through college in Columbus, Ohio, I trained in the hospital to be a respiratory therapist. And that's when I was on the front line of watching what happens after 30 years, 3 packs a day. Not pretty. And then I realized it's totally preventable.
Yeah.
And that set me on the path of prevention, to focus on prevention of drug abuse, prevention of diabetes, prevention of cardiovascular disease. And I discovered public health and never turned back.
Well, it's not often that you can have a job where you're really making the world a better place. And most people really dislike compliments. I've learned that in my career. So when I say that, most people do this like, oh, no. Everybody works hard. We all work hard. So I'm going to thank both of you for all of your colleagues. So you're representing all your colleagues, because somebody who's married to a nurse who was on the COVID floor, that was his job. That was not fun. And he would say that, well, he had the easy part compared to the poor patients who, sadly, a lot of them are no longer here today. Because in a lot of cases, they didn't believe that the virus was real, and they didn't want to take the vaccines, which is just, talking about preventable. I mean, just heartbreaking. But it's so important to get facts to the community. And it doesn't matter how the community gets them, but as long as they get the truth and facts and what the real deal is, it really makes such a difference for all of us.
You know, we talk about message and messenger. And so the barbers went into a studio using all of our words in public health and medicine and NIDA words, and they actually produced a song. You know what they call it? Health is wealth. And it's basically saying it's time for us to take a pledge to take control of our own health, and that health is wealth.
take your life, not twice. Gonna live this long, live strong. Gotta take care of your health. Gotta take it like it is your wealth. You gotta know, you gotta show. Everything is not about that dough. That's why.
When you started your journey in this, and equity is such an important part of the world, but also medicine, that I think a lot of folks who have never been looked side eye by a nurse or a doctor or somebody in a healthcare situation where they feel judged. I mean, as somebody who has a husband, I was asked, I asked to be for PrEP before I was married, and the doctor looked at me and said, "Well, why would you want to be on PrEP? You seem like a nice, clean young man." And I was like, "Are you kidding me?" I mean, I laughed when they asked me that question. I'm like, "Oh, well, I would rather take it now than come and say one day, boy, I wish I was on PrEP, you know." And it's just like, okay. But I had never had that happen to me. And I'm like, if you have had that yes. happen to you a lot, you do understand why equity is so important in the medical field.
And why addressing unconscious bias is so important. And you know what you just did for your audience? You just liberated some people to speak their truth. So I want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
And once you have that feeling of being judged, then you can appreciate when it happens when somebody walks through the door just because of the color of their skin
mm-hmm.
or just because of their gender identity. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to address now in our healthcare system. No judging, no shame.
One of the outcomes of this initiative that I want the audience to know about is we're also increasing awareness for the Black and Brown community to be members of the medical community. We're promoting diversity and inclusion, of course, as patients, but also as scientists for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So when we go out into the community and you see we teach even a 12-year-old how to give naloxone because she had a family member of hers pass away in her home, and she is now empowered to save perhaps, God forbid, another life down the road. But she looks at you and says, "Thank you. Now I know how to do this. And by the way, I want to be a nurse.
Go.
I want to be a doctor. I want to be a Dr. Thomas one day." That is literally why we do what we do with Dr. Thomas, and we're so grateful for that opportunity. So we really are changing the field of addiction, not only at the patient level, but also at the patient-provider level.
Generational.
Which is very important. Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
What Dr. Lisa Farinelli and Dr. Stephen Thomas, I can't thank you both enough. And we thank you for joining us for the Advancing the Science of Addiction, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Join us next time for another insightful episode. Until then, stay informed and take care.